Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's audio conference training on enhancing our work with men who use violence, offered by the Office on Violence Against Women in partnership with Praxis International. My name is Beth McNamara, and I will be your host for today's call. Before we begin, I'm going to go over my usual quick housekeeping details to let everyone know that we are recording this audio conference training. And our goal for recording this audio conference training is to put it on our website for online streaming, which means that at the conclusion of the entire series, we'll pull together the recordings, put them on our website, and then you can download them at your leisure. So if you have to step away from the call or you have other community partners who want to listen at another time but weren't able to make it to this call, it will be there for you to listen to. Our website is www.praxisinternational.org so that you have that logged in so you can find it again. Emails, materials for today's session were very brief. We sent out just the call topic, description, and the bios of our trainers for today, but they were sent out in your registration confirmation if you're interested in scrolling through those. While we get started, I will make sure that any other materials that are mentioned during this series, this training, as well as the rest of the series, I'll get those posted on our website and send them out so that you have access to those. And our one important disclaimer is that while OVW supports the notion that grantees have access to technical assistance and training and support from a whole variety of organizations and people, this training is presented by Praxis, and while we're supported by OVW to be a technical assistance provider for this grant program, the points of view that we're going to express, we need to be very clear, we're not speaking for OVW, we're speaking on behalf of Praxis, and the speakers who are on our call today, the trainers, are speaking on their behalf. So while we try very, very hard to stay in line with the guiding principles and this grant program and all of the other technical assistance providers work together to maintain a common unity around how we're pulling together ideas and notions and growing and continuing to critically think about it, we wanted to make sure that what you hear on the call doesn't mean that is what OVW is saying. We also would like to support and thank all of you for joining us on today's call and taking time out. We know the reality of all of your lives is incredibly busy, and we just appreciate the fact that so many people have registered for this call and are willing to sit down and talk with us for a minute about enhancing our work with men. Today is a first of a three-part series. So we've put together a three-part series that is working on enhancing our work with men in visitation centers. And while this is a topic that Praxis and the Family Violence Prevention Fund and a number of technical assistance providers have been putting forth a tremendous amount of effort over the years in trying to figure out how we can do this better in our visitation centers, so we just wanted to acknowledge the fact that all of us on the phone today have given, I know you've all given time and attention to thinking this through. We're still working through how we can make this better and continue to make this work better. But all of our ideas and thoughts have been really a comprehensive and group effort to make this work the very best we can. So I would like to introduce our two guest speakers we have on the phone with us today, Laura Conley, who is an intervention program manager for Advocates for Family Peace, which is a community in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. And through that program, she coordinates the Supervised Visitation and Exchange Center and also facilitates groups for men who use violence. And we also have Jennifer Rose on the phone with us today, who has spent her professional career as an advocate and an activist, to end violence against women. She also was the director of a domestic violence service organization in California, and through that organization also started a visitation center. She is now a consultant. And so as you can see, we have two amazing women with us today who have spent a lot of time thinking about how to enhance work with men in visitation centers, how to make visitation center work better for battered women and their children. And so with that, two other pieces before I turn it over. One is that we're going to try and be very intentional about taking time for questions and answers. So in about 30 minutes, we're going to take an intentional break for questions. But you don't have to wait for questions. The tricky little balance about this is that while there are a whole bunch of open lines, all of you are on an open line, we've tried to eliminate as much background noise as possible because the reality of what's happening in your world and your office is probably not always quiet. So we mute everyone's line, but in doing so, it makes it a little awkward to be able to participate in the call. So what we do have is Stephanie, who is our operator. She stays with us for the entire call, and if you push the number 1 on your keypad, you can talk to Stephanie, which means that she can help you with volume and those kinds of things, but she can also get you in the question queue. There is a bit of a delay, which means that it doesn't happen instantaneously. So if you have a question or you have something that you want to contribute, push number 1 and let Stephanie know that you'd like to ask a question. And when we break for questions, she can do that. We are also communicating online, so she can let me know if somebody is in the question queue, and we can try to take breaks as often as we can. So we want you to be able to participate. One other way we're going to ask that you participate is we're going to do a polling question, which means that we're going to pose a scenario and then a couple of options, and then when you do the polling, you do it on your keypad. It's anonymous. Nobody knows how you've responded, but it's a way to also be engaged in the call without needing to have to jump in and say anything if you don't do that. And then the third way that we are encouraging participation and your comments to be folded into this discussion is that you can email me during the call, and I would be happy to plop that into the discussion and pull it out for comments and questions. So you can email me at beth@praxisinternational.org, B-E-T-H at praxisinternational.org. I'll plop your question in anytime that comes. And I think with all of that said, those are all our housekeeping pieces. So I'm going to turn it over to Jen, and she's going to give us a little bit of grounding on our topic today, and then we're going to move ahead. Thanks, Jen.
Great. Thanks, Beth. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for getting on the call. I always appreciate this opportunity to continue this conversation with Laura and all of you, and really trying to work together to figure out how we can best enhance our work with men and really build our skills and capacity to engage men in a way that ultimately promotes safety for women, children, and the men that we serve. As Beth mentioned, I came to this work as a domestic violence advocate running a supervised visitation center, and the opening of our visitation center was a little bit of a challenge for me, and when our courts initially came to me and said, hey, we want you to open a visitation center, I really didn't see the connection or why that would be something as a domestic violence program we would want to do. It didn't take long for me to get a lot of clarity around why, in fact, it was very important for us as a domestic violence program to either open centers of our own or at least be really involved and engaged in the visitation centers in our community. And my experience with visitation centers historically hadn't been positive, and I think that's what really shaped and framed my thinking and my beliefs around the level of involvement we should or should not have. But it was around the time that OVW was taking up this issue of supervised visitation and really wanted to explore how we could provide visitation services that centralize safety, not just for children, but for adult survivors as well. And it was very quickly into the work that I saw the importance of really building strong relationships with the men who used our centers. In fact, that it was paramount in many ways to really providing a safe space for women and children to use our center as well. And through practice and through trial and error and making a lot of mistakes and most importantly talking to women, we learned that how we did our work with the men at the center had a great impact on the safety of women and children, both during the time of the visit as well as outside of the center, and that we needed to really continue to build these strong relationships in a way that promoted safety. And really learning that one of the key ways to do that was through this relationship building, and that those relationships had to be authentic. They had to be grounded in respect and understanding, as well as balancing the need for safety and recognizing battering and those different issues that were happening in the family, and how to hold both of those things at the same time. And we also learned, and research told us, that men who use violence aren't typically motivated to change their behavior towards their partners, but that through their children and learning about and better understanding their children's experiences, we had a lot of opportunities to motivate and create better opportunities for men to stop their battering and make better choices in their relationships, both with their children and ultimately with their either current or ex-partners. And so visitation really is an important place where we can have a positive impact on either minimizing and ultimately hopefully ending the violence that is happening, in particular with the families who we're serving. So as we started to explore, in particular, our work with men who use violence, and just to sort of frame this call, that I think these strategies and the things that we'll talk about are, of course, relevant to all men using visitation centers, but that we're really paying specific attention to men who have battered their partners. And so really an emphasis around men who batter as our key kind of target population that we're talking about in particular on this call. I know some of us have supervised visitation grant program grants and are really focused on centralizing safety for women and children, and I also know we have folks on the call who may not be doing that as intentionally, and so I just wanted to highlight that we're specifically talking about men who have used violence and who batter their partners. So some of these strategies, you know, it was interesting for me, are feel a little bit like common sense, right? And they're really building a foundation from the very beginning of comfort for everyone who's coming through our center. And in particular, we realized right away that we had men, women, and children coming to our center, and the women would come and we would offer them a cup of tea and we would try to make them feel as comfortable and as safe as possible. And the fathers were coming, the men were coming to our center, and one day I just spent some time observing, and I realized that my staff and myself even weren't even shaking his hand or weren't even acknowledging that he was sitting there. We were short, we were curt, we really didn't engage in the same way, and we explored why that was happening, and a lot of it was fear. You know, we were really operating from a fearful place, so this is someone who might be dangerous, and instead of meeting him with humanity, we would sort of meet him with a wall and our guards up, and recognized how important it was that we shifted just even our basic initial interactions and sort of the space that we created. Our waiting rooms for the women who were coming were a lot more welcoming and comforting, and I noticed that our waiting room for the men who came was kind of bleak, and it was a chair and a little table and really nothing that said, sit down, make yourself comfortable, you know, we're here to also serve you. And so some of those little basic things, just walking through the door, really had an impact as we started to change what it felt like to come to our center for a man who was visiting his child there. Preparing fathers for visits was another important piece that we learned. I think we somehow took for granted that this was really anxiety-provoking, didn't feel great. We realized it was artificial. We realized it wasn't ideal, but that, you know, people came with a lot of anxiety. They didn't know what to expect, and that anxiety really created a lot of tension and very often potential for risk at the center. And that the unknown, and that's true for all of us in our lives, not knowing often creates opportunities for us to be more hostile, more agitated, more confused. And so really starting to have a process in our orientation in an ongoing way, helping men prepare for visits with their children, preparing them for the worst-case scenario, right? On that first visit, you know, just know that this can be uncomfortable for children and a little bit awkward. They may be afraid for whatever reason. And we've had kids who come and don't want to go on that first visit, you know. And so we're going to work and hopefully have this happen. And at the same time, how can we support you in being prepared for the possibility that this might happen? And what do you think are some things we can do? And how can we work with you to sort of minimize that? Walking fathers through the center and really giving them opportunities to look at the things that we had for them to do with our kids, talking to them about the way they spent time with their children, really doing what we could to help build some ownership over the space for them so they felt, you know, that this was an okay place for them to see their children. They could set it up so that they were more prepared. And we found that that really helped minimize a lot of the anxiety when men felt a little more prepared and aware about all of the different possibilities. And we found it was really important to let them have a space to talk about what was going on, how they felt about it, what were their hopes, what were their expectations, what were the things that they wanted to do or see happen. And that also helped us learn information about where this father was coming from and how we could create and help support the best experience possible, which we learned ultimately created the most safety for the women and children who were coming. I think we have this idea that because someone's in a supervised visit that we have much higher expectations than we do for parents who are just out in the world every day. And, of course, we're looking and considering different things, in particular safety, but I think sometimes we expect this perfect visit to happen and we set up an environment that has no room for just being human and just working it out. And so really kind of letting go a little bit and allowing sort of those less perfect interactions, letting families kind of do their own thing and be in the space in as comfortable way as possible and not kind of picking every little thing that happens, but just knowing that if it's not a big safety concern, and that's why we're here to create safety and to make sure folks stay safe, that, you know, people's parenting may not be what we think it should be, but that's not our role. That's not what we're doing at that particular time. And so really allowing the family to be as authentic as they can in the space and being together helped so that parents and children didn't feel like we were watching every little thing they did and kind of constructing the way in which the visit was supposed to happen, which may not have been true to who this family was together. Learning about collusion, we'll talk about this a little bit more, and really understanding, you know, the role we can play in collusion, and that building a relationship and having respect for someone doesn't mean that we're colluding. It doesn't mean that we're ignoring the things that they're doing that may be creating risk. It doesn't mean that we're not paying attention to the reason why the family comes to the center, and that as we build relationships, of course, there's more opportunities for collusion because we start to trust people to some extent. We start to see them in a little different way than we maybe did when they walked through the door. So we need to be aware of those things, and at the same time, building relationship and having respect and working together does not always equal collusion. And I think finding that fine balance between paying attention to what's a risk and paying attention to what creates an even more safe and welcoming environment can actually produce better outcomes. Some other things, really partnering with your domestic violence programs is a key piece. Some of us are domestic violence programs running visitation centers. Some of us are independent visitation centers. But really having that strong relationship with your local program is an important piece. I know just from doing both types of work in visitation, I think it's a really unique thing that happens. And it was real important for us to always have a reality check from our DV partners who could help us identify perhaps battering tactics or things that might be happening that we wouldn't have seen without some outside lens. They really are the experts on battering and power and control and what's happening. And so those partnerships help us just always have a sounding board or a reality check around things that might be happening. And so that relationship can really help us better understand what's happening, your local batter intervention program, whatever it is, bringing in those partners to help us better understand tactics as well as strategies to build stronger relationships that don't compromise safety. Talking to women is an important piece as well. We always want to keep that survivor's voice and life and perspective kind of up front and center as well. Talking to women, learning from them, keeping the ongoing dialogue about what's happening outside of the center, those types of things just help us stay in check as we move forward in building better relationships and are more prepared to respond and create the safest place possible for everybody. And also getting some feedback around how things are going at the center does have an impact on what happens to her outside of the center. And so those relationships are equally as important in this process as we work towards enhancing our work with men and building our relationships. Take a breath here for a minute, see if there's anyone who has any questions or comments, or Laura, if you have anything you want to jump in and say at this point too.
So just a reminder, if you have a question, you want to join in the conversation, push number one and Stephanie will help you get in the question queue. Laura, do you want to add anything at this point?
I think you're doing great, Ms. Chen.
And I guess the last piece, and I think one of the most important pieces, is really being present, being curious, being authentic in our relationships. I think for me, when I started doing the work in visitation centers, I really had to confront my fear, right, and my fear of men who batter. And the stories that I'd heard and the things that I had conjured up in my head of possible risks that could happen at the center, and knowing the realities of families' lives. And I really had to spend time exploring for myself the way in which that fear got in the way of being really human and present with men, women, and children at the center, but in particular the men at the center. I'd been really comfortable working with better women and their kids in the program I was working at before when we opened a visitation center. And when I could really let go and see their humanity, and I could let go and see that these were people who made really bad choices, yes, they could be risks, but that there was this whole other part that was important to explore and learn about, you know, that really came from, I was privileged to be a part of, with the Family Violence Prevention Fund, their Fathering After Violence project, where we created a program with serving particularly Latino fathers using the supervised visitation center, and engaged some community folks who had made positive changes in their lives and started building relationships and did some groups with the men using the center, really opened my eyes and helped me understand that it's all really complex and their lives are complex. And if I could see all of the different pieces as part of the whole, I could engage in a much better way, which really helped us have better outcomes and more safety at our center and ultimately for the women and children who we're serving. And so with that, I'm going to hand it over to Laura to talk to us a little bit about how do we start building these humanizing relationships with the men who we serve in our centers.
And thanks. Before we do that, Laura, we do have one question in the question queue, so I'm going to have Stephanie open up their line so they can not have to hold for very long.
Great. Okay, our first question does come from Lana. Your line is open.
I know one of the things that you talked about is trying to allow them to have a visit and be as natural as possible. One of the things with our supervised visits is so many of the parents want to discuss the court case and why they're going through a supervised visit, mm-hmm. and we don't allow them that conversation. I'm curious how other supervised visits handle that, because it is an important conversation to have with the children, yet, you know, it's something, again, that we try to deter them from so that there are no conversations about the other party. So how do you guys handle that?
I'll say a quick something, and then I'm going to hand it over to Laura, too, because I know they've done a lot of thinking and work around this as well.
Okay.
You know, for us, I know a lot of us have that policy or that practice where we don't want those sort of adult conversations to happen or the reason why people are coming to the center. Like, we try to keep it just a fun, open space. And that's where we started, and we really shifted when there were opportunities and it made sense and we could keep it safe, We did allow some of those conversations to happen, but they happened with a lot of preparation. You know, if a father wanted to have a conversation with their child about why they were here or what was happening, it wasn't just in the moment. At least we try not to let it happen in the moment. But we, in our orientation, we would say, you know, these things sometimes come up. And if this is something you know, that comes up for you, we need to talk about it before it happens. And we would sit down and we would have a conversation with him during some time outside of the visit and either role play or practice and let him know that if it starts to move in a certain direction, we will have to stop the conversation. Or if your child begins to, you know, get visibly really upset and you're not able to sort of stay present, then we will redirect or we'll shift it. But we did a lot of work in preparing for some of those conversations and allowed them to happen sometimes. Because the reality is kids, we try to keep it from kids, but they really know. And if the conversation can be safe, we found that it had some really positive outcomes for the children in particular. And some healing components that really helped move people forward in a good way. And Laura, I know, has some experiences, too. I'd like her to share with us.
I think, thank you, Jen and Beth, for having me. And it, just quickly in response to that question, I think that is most certainly, you know, an example of all of the stuff that Jen's been talking about so far in terms of we have to really examine what sort of policies and practices we have in place and how that actually plays out in people's lives. Because I do think that not allowing people to have those types of conversations is easier on us as visitation workers than it is on the people who want to have those types of conversations. And I think that one thing that we've noticed over the years, because we, too, used to have a policy that said that people couldn't talk about those sorts of things, and we were having experiences where many people wanted to. And a lot of times those conversations were being initiated by the children. And so we just kind of stepped back and took a look at what was going on and talked with, you know, a lot of people who were using our services, the men, women, and, you know, children who were old enough to discuss it about. So the last time that the family was together was a really violent episode, which led to court, which led to supervised visits. So the kids most likely do have a lot of questions about that. And like Jen is saying, if you can work with people around, most certainly these conversations probably are better to be had supervised than when they're no longer supervised in some ways, because you can set some parameters around, you know, how much minimizing and blaming is going on during that time. But that ultimately it became more helpful in terms of the visits thereafter not being so full of anxiety and fear for the people who were using the service.
So
I guess basically it's one of those policies and practices that I would spend some time really examining. Why do you have that in place? Is it to benefit the people who work at the center, or is it a safety mechanism for the people who come there? I would dig into that one a little bit.
Thank you. I didn't know if there was a best practices on that, because it is certainly much easier on us, but for the children that are old enough to comprehend what is transpiring, it's certainly harder for them.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Lana.
So, are there any more questions?
I don't believe there are, but
we actually do have an additional question at this time.
Goodness, we have a talkative group. This never happens this early.
This is great.
And that question does come from Sally. Your line is open.
Hi, Sally.
I did not request the line to be open. I have no question.
All right. Well, thanks for checking in, Sally, and maybe if you have a question later, check in. All right, Laura, we'll carry on.
Okay. So now the question is, you know, how do you actually really build these humanizing relationships with men who are coming to the center? And I'm going to kind of speak through this through my own experience doing this work, because I think it's the easiest way for me to articulate this. I've been with the Supervised Visitation Center for probably going on 7 years now. And when we first started looking at the way that we were working with the people we serve, we most certainly had a supervised visitation center where we were trying to make the people fit into our services rather than our services fit the people who were coming there. And one of the things that we noticed right away after we started engaging with the folks that we were serving, and in particular talking with the mothers who were dropping their children off to visit their dads, is that the backlash of the fathers not having a good, or I don't, for lack of a better word, good experience at the visitation center didn't necessarily play out to the visitation center or to our staff, but it played out with her and the kids in some way. So we started to look at this through, okay, we need to figure out a way where the men who are using this services also feel comfortable and want to be here, because ultimately that's what's going to keep the mother and the children safe. So when we started to do that, we realized that as staff, we needed to spend a lot of time examining our own beliefs about the men who batter. And I think that one thing that became very clear to us early on is that, yes, many of the behaviors of the men who were coming to us were similar and, you know, almost seemed the same in some ways, that the men themselves were different and they all had their own unique set of life circumstances that they were bringing to us that were valuable for us to know and understand and to validate in order for them to feel comfortable using our services as well. And so once we started that process of really looking at that, it created an opportunity for us to challenge our own assumptions about the men and to start to move away from really making generalizations about them. Our supervised visitation center is run by the local domestic violence organization, so a lot of our training is very rooted in domestic violence, power and control issues, and myself and another safety center staff person facilitates the men's group as well as doing supervised visits. So we were able to really come together and start to look at how can we create a space that is safe for women and children and also for men, and to create a relationship between the men that we serve that would allow for there to be more of an equal exchange of information. So what I mean by that is that, you know, he would most certainly be open to hearing what we have to say about the way this center operates and, you know, our expectations of him. And then we would receive what he has to say about his anxiety about the visits. You know, most of the people that are coming to the center after OFP, Order for Protection Court, or criminal court, come there with anxiety, they have anger about the system, and they really have this need to have you understand their side of the story. And so we were, you know, seeing this, we're talking with the people that we're serving, we're talking with each other, and we realized that if we could create a relationship with people, ultimately what happens then is they're better able to receive our feedback about things that we see as continued abusive behavior. And it ultimately led to them being better able to do some self-reflecting rather than immediately getting defensive about it. And I think that as long as a supervised visitation center can be really transparent and forthcoming with everybody who's using their services about, you know, one of the primary purposes of the center is to keep adult and child victims of domestic violence safe, that you can do this in a way that isn't colluding. Because I know that when we've had these conversations over the years about working with men, that people get really nervous that when you start to do this, you are colluding. And the interesting thing about it is that you do spend, in our community, primarily the non-custodial or non-residential parent who's being ordered to the visitation center is male. So we're spending more actual time with the men because that's who we see at the visits. And we have a process where, you know, we're calling the mother afterwards just to check in with her and see how everything's going. So we have that sort of a relationship going as well. But it can easily be perceived that you're just spending all your time with the man and, you know, buying in, for lack of a better word, to what he has to say about how everything is going. And so I think that when you're trying to create these relationships with people, it's really about creating a balance between supporting the person who's coming to you, working through some of the anxieties and resentments that they might have about suddenly having to be ordered to see their children supervised, and then also get yourself in a position where you can begin to maybe reflect back and challenge some of the abusive behaviors that you're seeing. And I think that one of the ways to do this, aside from just really trying to engage with people on a human level, is to also constantly look at your policies and procedures that you have in place at your center. One of the fascinating things that I've learned over these last 7 years about this work is that I think a lot of times we get stuck in this idea that we can't change, that we can't try new things, that if we step away from a form of how to do supervised visits, that we might do something wrong. And I most certainly think that it's beneficial to the people that we serve to constantly look at how can we do this better? How can we make these services something that meets the needs of the people we serve? How do we make our services fit them rather than have them fit our services? And I think that when you start to look at your program in terms of policies and procedures, you really want to, like, the work can be done on a continuum, one end of the continuum being this agent of social control, which has many rules. It has a lot of one-size-fits-all approaches. It views a lot of the people that you serve in kind of a less-than perspective. And then at the other end of the continuum is this agent of healing, which is usually more supportive. It's seen as a resource to the people that it serves rather than just another institution that's kind of in people's business. And it really works with people to problem solve, and it doesn't try to cram people into a box. So I think part of this whole idea of really having a humanizing relationship with the men that we serve is to step back a little bit and just get to know where they're at. Because even if where they're at is uncomfortable for you, it's going to be helpful in the long run to gauge how the services should play out. And ultimately, it's safer for the women and children, in my experience.
So, Laura, I have a question that came via email.
Okay.
So I'm just going to pose that, and then we can talk about it a little bit.
Okay.
But this question asks, what if a monitor has developed an authentic relationship with the father, but the mother has continued to undermine the dad's effort to build a relationship with the child, such as no birthday presents, or has grounded the child not to allow any toy time during the visits, which did result in a backlash against her outside the visitation center? How do you effectively work with her?
Okay, so I'll try to answer this, and then, Jen, if you have anything,
sure,
please say. So this is obviously a scenario that can be complex because I don't necessarily know the context in which this happened. But I'm assuming, you know, if this is a situation where there's a long history of domestic violence, there are some things that you have to be careful of. So one thing with our center is we do allow people to bring gifts, and we do allow people to bring guests. And that time that parent, the non-custodial or non-residential parent, has is their time. And unless there's a court order stating otherwise, we do allow people to do those sorts of things. With that being said, if I was working with a mother who had a lot of concerns about that, I would try to dig into what is that about? You know, is this coming from a place of fear in terms of the abuse that you've experienced? And try to navigate through that. And hopefully, based on the, you know, if you really do have this authentic relationship with the man who's coming there, that you can pose some of these things in terms of, you know, it's great that you want to bring gifts and you want to do these things with your children, but can I just explain to you maybe some of the possible backlash because of that? I think that another big piece to this in the way that sometimes the custodial parent or the mother in this scenario get in trouble for this is that maybe the court doesn't necessarily have the best understanding of the visitation center's role. Jen, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's often, I mean, it's a dilemma that we run into. And And sometimes, and for me, what it highlights is the importance of this sort of parallel process that we're working on. And I think as we're working to build strong relationships with the men who use our centers, that we do have to have this equal effort and opportunity to build relationships with the women as well, so that we can have these conversations. Because I think what we know is that it's very often the first opportunity a woman who's been battered has to start trying to exert some control over her life. And she may do it in ways that may be more harmful in the long run, or we may see as, maybe not the best choice to make, and that it has an impact on the children. And so how are we kind of simultaneously working to do this piece with men in our centers, and working with women to gain sort of power and control of their lives in a really positive way, and that they're not that we can sort of support them in these decisions that they make and kind of help direct in a way that's more positive and isn't impacting the child in the way that ends up impacting the child. So I don't know if that makes sense, but I just think that's got to be a part of it, is that sort of parallel process, because it's really common. I mean, I remember, I can talk about a number of families where that really came up, and it was because of either my relationship or my relationship with with the advocates at the program who could connect with that woman and sort of work with her in really positive ways to help move out of holding on to things that weren't, that she really cared about those things, but those were the few things she felt she could hold on to, and start having some control in her life. And so these partnerships and these relationships we build are really essential, because this is the kind of stuff that will sort of bubble up and that we'll have to work with and work through with families at our centers.
And the other piece I think is also helpful is this parallel process is very important. As Jen and Laura both had mentioned, there's also this piece that many women have told us, is that when they come to the center, they have gone through a tremendous amount that we just, as a visitation center, only get a small glimpse of it. And the more women trust that we can understand their experience and validate their experience, and that they can trust that we are there for her safety and her child's safety, the more that we can express that and show that, it definitely minimizes her need to be hypervigilant about what's happening at the visit. And that sometimes in this work that we're doing with women and with men, if we direct those conversations with her about what is it that's behind those concerns, why are you holding on to this, what does this signify for you? If you can kind of break those down, there's opportunities to then talk about what you're paying attention to, what you understand to be her reality, and what she's concerned about, and then address it that way. So she doesn't have to be the holder of what's happening even outside of what's happening in front of her, that it's happening in front of us. So sometimes that's a way in which you can figure out what's behind. Because sometimes you'll get requests that just seem off the wall, or just they don't make sense. But in her reality, they make a tremendous amount of sense. But if you give time and attention to helping figure that out, you may have a little bit more success. All right. So I don't have any more email questions, so we can carry on, but please feel free to continue to do that if you want to, and we can bring those questions in. Stephanie, before I turn it back over to Laura, are there any questions in the queue?
At this time, there are no questions in the queue.
Okay, very good. All right.
Okay. So I think now, Jen, or maybe we should go into the scenario?
Yeah.
Okay.
So now we want to give us an opportunity, and hopefully, and I've done a number of these calls, and it's great to have people chiming in, and whether it's on the call or through an email and participating, because, you know, we're all learning together. And if you have this question, chances are other people may be thinking about it too, and it gives us an opportunity to bring it up. So please continue to chime in at any time. But we wanted to pose a scenario and give us an opportunity to apply some of the things we were just talking about around, you know, effective strategies for building relationships and ways in which we build humanizing relationships, and how do we do this in a good way. And we thought a way that we could think through this together would be to put it into a real context, a real family situation, and then give us some options to move through. And this is where we'll do a little polling, and you'll have an opportunity to press in your response, and we'll give you some directions when we get to that piece. But I'm going to start by reading a brief scenario about a family, and then we'll move on to sort of the situation that we want to look at and kind of explore the different responses we might have. So our story today is, our family is Stan and Lisa, and Stan and Lisa were married for 13 years, and they have two children together. Lisa left Stan last year after a violent episode when he screamed at her for hours about how worthless and stupid she was, and ended up jumping on top of her and strangling her, letting her go right before she was about to pass out. When Lisa tried to call 911, Stan hung up the phone and would not let Lisa answer it when the dispatcher tried to call back. The police arrived, took both of their statements, arrested Stan, and left Lisa at home with the two children. There is a criminal no-contact order in place, and the only way Stan can see the children is through the visitation center. The visitation center staff does an orientation with Lisa, and she expresses some of her concerns with Stan's ability to minimize the situation to everyone, including the children. And Lisa continues to just express her concerns about things that Stan might say during the visit and the way he might treat the children. So with that being our scenario, we just did our orientation with Lisa, and now we are going to do an orientation with Stan. And during Stan's orientation, he shows up and he immediately begins talking about the children and how excited he is to see the children and his love for the children. And he asks, you know, when will you bring them in? And you let Stan know that this is actually his orientation, and after the orientation we'll be able to set up time for a visit, but he won't actually see the children today. Once you say that to Stan, he visibly gets upset. And he starts going off about Mrs. Smith, Lisa, and tells you that she is a terrible mother and that this is all her fault. So our question to you all now is, what do you do at this point? What do you do when Mr. Smith, Stan, begins to go off and start bad-mouthing Mrs. Smith about what a terrible mother she is during this first orientation?
Okay, so this is how polling works, is that I'm going to read all of the choices. Before you make a selection, our operator needs to open up the polling. So let me read all of the choices before you make your selection on your phone. And Stephanie will announce when the polling session is now open, and then push your response, and then she'll collect them, and then we'll move on from there. So if you believe... So the question at this point is, at this very point, you as a staff member have some choices. And so if your choice is to carry on with the orientation and make note about his comments, you would want to push number one. Don't do it quite yet, but that would be what you would be pushing, number one, if you think you would carry on with the orientation at this point and just make note of what he's saying. Push number two. If you want to acknowledge his concerns about Mrs. Smith's parenting and then carry on with the orientation. And push number three, if you confront Mr. Smith about his comments right in that moment. So those are the choices.
Okay, to participate in today's polling, once again, please press 1 for yes, 2 for no, and 3 if you're unsure. Polling is now in session.
So I'll repeat those. One, you're pushing one if you carry on with the orientation and just make a mental note of the comments that he's just made to you. Push two if you're acknowledging his concerns about Mrs. Smith's parenting and then you want to carry on with the orientation. And number three, you would choose to confront Mr. Smith about his comments. I'll give you a couple minutes, and then Stephanie will close the polling.
And those polling results have been saved.
Thank you, Stephanie. All right, so it'll be a few minutes before they're collated and sent, so I'll respond as soon as we get them. But Jen and Laura, why don't we just have a conversation about kind of all three of these scenarios and kind of the implications for each one of them and things to think about.
Great. And before we start, is there anyone right away who has sort of an initial response that they want to share?
So Stephanie's gathering up, so getting a question in the queue right now is kind of difficult.
Oh, okay.
Too many ones being pushed. Sorry.
So, Laura, you want to start with this first option,
sure.
Just carrying on with the orientation and making note of the comments. What are your responses or thoughts about that?
First, I just want to say that, when we know that there are many, many, many ways that people could choose to respond to a situation like this, and that we were just kind of trying to pull together some pretty general ways that this could play out that might be common. And when I think about the first one in terms of just carry on with the orientation and make notes about his comments, I think that, part of this process in terms of really creating supervised visitation services that are safe is to look at what is our orientation. I mean, what does that look like? Is our orientation more about just, us filling out forms and letting people know how the center works, or is our orientation grounded in this idea that we want to start to create a relationship with the people that we serve? So if it's grounded in this idea that we think that relationships are a gateway to safety, then I think that carrying on with the orientation in my mind would look like a situation where you're going to let Stan express where he's at, and then you're going to try to take that and also at the same time express to him what your expectations are of him once the visitation does start. When I look at number two, acknowledging his concerns about Mrs. Smith's parenting and carrying on with the orientation, that too is another one of those where if you're trying to create an environment where Stan has some space to be human and state his frustrations and where he's at, then you're probably going to handle that in a way where, okay, Stan, I can hear what you're saying and I hear your frustrations. I don't think that you necessarily have to agree with him on any level about her parenting because we don't know that. And, based on our orientation with her and the history that brought them there, we're looking at this through a lens of Stan's the visiting parent. He doesn't need to necessarily convince us of whether or not she's a good or bad mom, even though he might spend some time trying to do that. So just simply validating the fact that he's frustrated about the whole situation can be helpful. And then the last one about confronting him about his comments, I think can be a little bit tricky, especially if it's just at orientation. I mean, there most certainly might be times where it takes on a whole nother meaning and goes to a level where your intuition is telling you, okay, I need to stop this because this is just going too far. This isn't a safe situation. But there's also times within orientations where if you've spent enough time listening that there becomes a moment where you can reflect back to the person, wow, you just spent the last half hour talking to me about what a horrible mother she is, and I'm just really curious to know what's your understanding of why you are here, not based on that you think it's her fault, something along those lines. So I think that overall, probably a combination of all would be the most helpful to the family.
Okay, Jen, before we move on, I do have the polling results.
Great.
And so I just wanted to give a disclaimer. This is not a scientific research study here. We do realize that multiple people are listening on one phone, and so you only have the ability for one person to push one number. So take that for what it's worth, but just as a idea of how this shaped up for people in their mind, seven people indicated they would carry on with the orientation and make note of his comments. 13 people indicated they would acknowledge his concerns and carry on with the orientation, and 16 people indicated they would confront Mr. Smith, and then a whole bunch of you, much more than responded, said nothing. So our next polling question, you'll have another opportunity, but it's okay to push. We don't know who you pushed and who you are when you push the button, but that's how it shaped up.
Now that Stephanie's free to put people in the queue, do folks have any responses, or were there any, you know, was there something else that when you were hearing the scenario and the situation, things that you might have wanted to do or say?
So Stephanie, do we have anybody in the question queue?
At this time, I show no guests in the question queue.
Okay, very good.
So before we move on to Laura, thanks for sort of looking at these different responses. And, you know, I think for us as we were thinking about these, it's really a combination of things that really bring out the best result. And when we think about our earlier discussion around how we tailor our interactions and building our relationships, I think it's a really important piece. And this first interaction at orientation is really the springboard for your relationship in an ongoing way. Not that it's the only opportunity to kind of shape your relationship, but it is that first interaction that's longer than a phone call, where it's face-to-face and you're really getting to know somebody. And I think our front-end work, the conversations that we have, the interactions that we shape in this very initial part of our services is really important. And I think how we balance, right, these opportunities to reduce and minimize opportunities for ongoing battering, where we want to confront battering as we may see it starting to happen and shape up, are really important. And I think, as Laura mentioned earlier, the relationships that we build give us more opportunities to, in the long run, have conversations like, you know, Mr. Smith, you've been coming here for a few months, and we've been working together, and I was hoping maybe after the visit we could check in about some things. And I've noticed, you know, on a number of occasions you've sort of put down or made comments about, you know, your kid's mom, and how do you think that feels for them? You know, do you think that has any impact on your kids? And it gives us a chance to kind of dig deeper and sort of explore these things, as opposed to not having much of a relationship. Those very comments could be very escalating or triggering. So I think thinking about how these first steps shape our opportunities in the future, and sort of our long-term work around safety and opportunities for change is an important piece. And so being true to ourselves and who we are, some of us can have conversations in a particular way that feels it's maybe a little more casual, and some of us are more formal, and sort of paying attention to that and our own authenticity is also important, because people read that. Kids read it, we know that for sure, and I think adults read it as well. And the more real we can be, I think the more opportunities for connections that can create these opportunities for safety and change are important. Laura, you have any last thoughts on this particular scenario? And I think we have time to get through one more.
Okay. I'll just say one last thing about this one in particular is that I think that sometimes it's easy to believe that just by the nature of listening to somebody that ultimately means that you're agreeing with them. And I think that for me it's been an experience of just taking the time to really listen to people, even when I don't necessarily agree with them, or even if I have seen, you know, the police reports and I've talked with her extensively and it, you know, just everything isn't adding up from him, that just by the nature of being and being in a space where I'm listening to him and still kind of trying to draw out the humanness in him has led to a situation where he starts to feel more comfortable using the visitation center and some of that stuff ceases. And then we can start to really talk about it in a different way, which has been interesting to see over the years. So with that said, we'll go on to the next visitation situation. Do you want me to read this one, Jen?
Sure.
Okay. So we're having a visit now, and Stan arrives for his first visit. And when you go to get the children and return to the visitation room, Stan looks at his son and says, "Hey, buddy, tell your mom you need a haircut." So now we're going to do a polling question.
Okay. So remember not to answer until Stephanie tells you the polling session is open, but these will be your options. So at this very moment, as a visitation monitor, you hear that he says, "Hey, buddy, tell your mom you need a haircut." You would push 1 if you stop the visit and talk to Mr. Smith right then. Push number 2 if you tell Mr. Smith to change the conversation. Or push number 3 if you continue with the visit with no interruption. Stephanie, is the polling now open?
Polling is now in session.
Thank you. So I'll repeat the answers as you push your buttons. Push number 1 if you want to stop the visit and talk to Mr. Smith right then. Push number 2 if you tell Mr. Smith right in the moment to change the conversation. And push number 3 if you continue the visit with no interruption. Okay. While Stephanie's gathering up the responses, Laura, do you want to go through the options and just explore them a little bit?
So this is another one of those where whenever these sorts of situations come up, I'm always kind of trying to run them through more of a philosophical approach and perspective. So in terms of what would I do if something like this happened, then I start to ask myself, you know, what are some of the reasons why I would maybe intervene on this? Do I intervene on this because it's making me uncomfortable? Am I going to intervene on this because the child appears uncomfortable? Am I going to intervene on this because this is something that I've talked with Mrs. Smith about, and I know that this is there's a long history behind these sorts of comments? And then with that being said, I think that from a visitation center standpoint, you have to really look at how what you choose to do plays out, because it's not just something that only plays out within that visit. It plays out beyond that visit. And so, like, just if you were to stop the visit and talk to Mr. Smith, that would be one approach. The center that I work for tends to be a little bit more on the unobtrusive end. We tend to, you know, let things kind of organically happen as much as possible within some parameters of safety and, of course, you know, not being abusive or violent within the visit. The idea of telling Mr. Smith to change the conversation, which most certainly is on the range of options, I think that your delivery of that and how you go about that will probably play out differently within the visit. And I think, like what Jen was saying earlier, in terms of, you know, some people are just better able to engage with people on a level where it doesn't create defensiveness, and some of us have a harder time with that, which is fine. It's just a matter of finding a good fit for the people that you serve. Because ultimately, I think in these types of scenarios, we really want to de-escalate it rather than add a lot more drama to it. So, you know, the other option then is you could continue the visit without any interruption. And if you did that, then I would most certainly take into consideration what you would want to talk with the parties about after the visit is over, because chances are that that little boy is going to tell his mom that his dad said that. So I think it's always important to check in with her afterwards so that she knows that you were there and you heard it and this is what you did with it. And also, you know, to check in with Stan afterwards if you feel the need to about those comments. Jen, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, before I do, I just want to see it. Oh, we're still waiting for our polling results.
Nope, we have them if you want me to. give them to you before you go?
First, I just want to open up, see if anyone had any responses or thoughts about this little situation and what they might do.
Okay, so while I'm giving the polling results, if you have a question, push number one. You'll pop into the question queue. There'll just be a minute of delay. So while you're doing that, I'll let you know that 3 people responded that they would stop to the visit right then and talk to Mr. Smith. 17 people would tell Mr. Smith to change the conversation right then. 14 people would continue with the visit with no interruption, and the rest of you, which were more than any other response, again, did not respond. So we have a lot of hesitation, mystery, don't know, or kind of processing, I think, is where that lump of folks are.
And can I just say on that sometimes I think that's okay, that we don't necessarily know mm-hmm. what the right response is in the moment, but more importantly, just to have a gauge on how it all plays out, because that will help us create a response for the next scenario.
Right. And always just kind of moving through and critically thinking about how we can do this better each and every time, because there is no ever perfect response.
Absolutely.
We can always think of ways to enhance our work and challenge ourselves and keep moving. So I think every opportunity is an opportunity to grow and learn and not shame yourself for, gosh, I did that wrong, because you'll just get nowhere other than frustrated. All right, we do have a question, Jen, before...
Go ahead.
We move on. Stephanie, can you open up their line?
Okay. Our first question does come from Anne. Your line is open.
Hi, Anne.
Hi. Thank you. My question is, and it's actually more of a comment about the very first part of the scenario, because it occurred to me that part of the way that we deal with that and work with battered women is that we make sure that they have all the information that they need about what's likely to happen to them along the way, and that it makes sense to me that we would do that when we're working with men at visitation centers as well. And so part of Stan's frustration is that he thought he was going to see his children at the orientation, and we might have been able to deal with that if he had had information about what was actually going to occur and not occur at the orientation. So part of it seems like to me is the strategy might be is making sure that everybody who's working at the visitation center has as much information as they can have about what's likely to happen when they get there.
And I think that's a great comment. You know, it's so easy for us as visitation center staff to be comfortable in our own process. We come to work every day. It's our space. We've created it. We're comfortable with it. We know how the process works. And it's so easy to forget that not everybody knows and feels comfortable with this space. Like, we know where we're putting our coat. We know where we put our lunch. You know, we know who's working there. We know exactly how to get messages and leave messages, all that stuff. And when you're first coming as a participant, you know nothing. And you sometimes as a staff member lose that ability to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. So I love your reminder. Thanks. Stephanie, do we have any other questions?
Yes, our next question does come from Cheryl. Your line is open.
Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I actually just have a comment really based on just what we previously heard, but with Stan, we have found here for the most part that each situation is unique, and I think it begins with the communication, as the previous party just had said, allow each party that is involved know ahead of time what they're coming into, what is happening. So we work very closely with the advocates, with the court system as well, so that they pretty much have an idea that they're not going to see their child the first time come for orientation. And having said that, we have several monitors that I think is really important to recognize. We all bring to the table something different from our past, from who we are, and it's a unique situation. So, you know, there's no right or wrong answer, I don't think, for all the things that you had suggested, that I think it's what you feel comfortable with and what your rapport is with that client.
Yep, sure. I think you're exactly right on. It's really important. I think the other piece to be reminded of is I know OVW has put out some guiding principles, 6 guiding principles for all of us to follow in our work, and one of those is recognizing and understanding battering. So regardless of what your choice is in the moment, you know, we posed 3 possible options. There's probably 300 more possible options that you could consider. But I think as long as you're continually challenging yourself to make sure that you're grounded in an understanding of why families are using your services and what is happening in the moment with what's going on, your response as you build this relationship with families and as you try to account for their safety in the best way possible should always be couched in this understanding and recognizing battering. So, you may have a situation with Stan where he is purposely undermining her parenting as a battering tactic. In the situation, that may not be what he's doing. And so it's our job to figure out what all of this means in the larger context of people's lives so that we can respond in the best way possible. And what that means is it just can't happen in a glimpse of a moment, that it's a time when we gather up as much information as we can and we make informed decisions jointly with everybody who uses our services. And that means talking, lots and lots of talking about what's happening, what does this mean for you, what are the implications, because you're right, some families, if you make a big deal out of this, it's much more dangerous for her. And sometimes if you let it go, it's much more dangerous for her. So you just never know that you can plop one scenario into one response each and every time and have good results. So,
and
go ahead.
Oh, and I just wanted to add, each person is so different and unique and will react and respond in different ways, and how we build relationships with them is how we work with Mr. Smith may be very different than how we work with Mr. Jones or Mr. Gonzalez or all of the different people who come through our doors, and that it's really about creating opportunities for some critical thinking and strategies for ongoing engagement that isn't about sort of one opportunity but is about a process and the ongoing movement forward and the way we build together in an ongoing way, and recognizing we may make some mistakes here and there, or we may, you know, walk away and say, oh, I wish I would have done that different. But that if it's a part of a process and not just a moment in time, then we always have opportunities to go back and keep shaping it in the way that we want to shape our relationships, in particular as they move towards safety and those opportunities for change.
We have one email question, and it's a rather large question. I also try to email them back with a little bit of a clarification, but I don't have a response yet, so we're just going to go with this question and kind of make some assumptions about what it was that they were asking. And to know that this is a very big question, so we may not be able to do it justice, but I don't want it to go unresponded to. So the question is that this particular center has had a number of what they are describing as a number of females being considered the batterer in the past few months. And do you feel as batterers they need to be treated and dealt with and responded to in a different way? What I tried to clarify is whether they are being labeled the batterer or whether they're being ordered to be the visiting parent at a visitation center, because those are two important distinctions. And that's not the piece of information that I have, but Jen, is there something that you wanted to kind of respond?
You know, I mean, I would respond if it was that we're talking about the visiting parent and they're being ordered to visit their children, and so that's sort of how they're getting labeled as the batterer. I think, goodness, I mean, I think we want to explore where their experience, you know, and are they in fact the one using violence, and what is the context for that violence that they may be using, and is it in response to being a survivor of ongoing battering, or, you know, what is the context, because that will shift how we move forward and think about those relationships. And it's really no different. I mean, I think we're ultimately always thinking about safety, and to make decisions that are about safety that don't create risk, you know, you're not doing any harm necessarily, and you want to build on those relationships in the same way as you would build a relationship with anybody coming to the center. And I think the more time you take to get to know the people, you'll learn more about what's really happening, and that will help you to shape the relationships, the collaborative partnerships, and any sort of support or intervention that you end up doing with that family based on kind of what you learn as you're building that. So, I mean, the reality is, I think it's not really all that different. However, your considerations for safety change based on who needs protection from whom and what are the risks that are involved. But that anytime you're doing something in line with creating safety, then chances are you're not going to create risks on the other side of that.
Right. Because inherently, our systems that are in place in all of our communities unfortunately attach labels in lots of different ways. Whether they come through the family court system, people are labeled custodial and non-custodial parent, visiting and non-visiting parent. And so as a visitation center, we kind of have to untangle that and decide and determine what our role is as a visitation center and then respond accordingly, not based on the label that somebody comes to our door with. But if we're truly there for safety, then we have to unpack who needs protection and how we can ensure the person who needs protection in a variety of ways. So how they're coming and going from the center, what's happening at the center, all of those kinds of ways shouldn't be impacted by kind of the label that somebody comes with, whether they're the visiting parent or not, or whether somebody is telling you that they're both victims. You know, however this happens in front of you, you're really trying to unfold how your center can respond to making sure that the person who needs protection in an equal regard way, meaning the victim and the child equally, gets that protection from you. And I just looked at the time, and I try very hard to be respectful of all the time that you've taken to be with us, so I want to unfortunately wrap up our call. And so to let, first of all, a public acknowledgement for Jen and Laura for taking the time to be with us today. I appreciate it tremendously. Your insight has been invaluable, and I want to thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
This is the first of a three-part series, so I wanted to remind you the same time, same channel, same way in which you called in today. You can call in next week for part two of our series on dealing with problematic behavior in our search for enhancing our work with men in visitation centers. Scott Hampton is going to be an additional guest on our call next week. So that will be what's happening. And then the final part of the series will happen the following Wednesday. I'm going to email out an evaluation of this call, and I would appreciate it if you would take some time to just plop in your thoughts. It'll be an online survey, so what I send out to you is a link for an online survey. It's really fast. I try not to give you too many questions, but your feedback is tremendously important, so I would appreciate hearing back what you'd like. We also have the opportunity, because this is the first call, to respond to your comments and questions. If you plop them in, we'll try to accommodate those in the next two pieces of this series. So more motivation to fill out the evaluation. And Jen and Laura, I'm going to give you just one quick chance to say any parting remarks, and then we'll end our call for the day.
This is Laura. Thank you so much for having us on and listening to what we have to say. I really just think that this is such an important piece to the work, and really getting to know the people that we serve and engaging with them, I do believe ultimately leads to the safest services. So thank you.
And Jen?
And I will echo that. Thank you for your time and your hard work. I think supervised visitation work is really some of the hardest work out there, and that this piece of it challenges us all in different ways, and to engage in it and to really see people as humans, to work towards creating better opportunities. Thank you, everyone. Billy, creates the best outcome for our families and for our community. So thank you, and keep up your hard work.
Thank you, everybody. We'll chime in next week. Have a good day.